Welcome back. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about the characteristics of a perfect human being according to Islamic teaching. And in the first segment, we were talking about the popularity of the Prophet and the concept of Izzah. Now, this is referred to as Izzah, and Quran says, وَلِلَّهِ الْعِزَّةُ وَلِرَسُولِهِ. The true popularity, the true esteem, respect is for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and for the Prophet and the true followers. So we were also talking about the fact that some people, biased historians or people would say that they try to depict the picture of the Prophet of Islam that he got more aggressive as the time went on. Like, for example, the start of his community in Mecca, he was not aggressive, and then he got aggressive when in Medina, and as he went into power. Like, normally this happens with these leaders. For example, the leaders, as much as they hold control, more power, they become more oppressive, something like this. And they try to apply this pattern in the life history of the Prophet. But this is unfair and unreal because, as I said, you have examples of great levels of forgiveness that the Prophet of Islam actually shows right at the most powerful moments of his life. And that what makes it very beautiful and unique in human history. Like, one of them was the day that the triumph of Mecca took place. The other is when certain members from among the companions, from among the community of the Prophet ﷺ, in Laylatul Aqaba, there is this story of the night of the narrow pathway. Aqaba means narrow pathway. So the Prophet of Islam was passing through this narrow pathway, which was on the brink of a cliff, and certain people tried to make the camel of the Prophet fall into the cliff. And then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala informed the Prophet through revelation, and the plot failed, actually, the assassination attempt failed. So then later on, another companion of the Prophet asked him, okay, did you know him? And the Prophet said, yes, I know all of them. I saw their faces and I knew them even before. But then that companion asked him, why don't you take any measures against them? And he said, I just forgive them. One reason for that is that I don't want other people to see that when Muhammad prevailed, he put sword among his own followers. So you see that this level of forgiveness, that it is not at all like that when I have power, I do whatever I want. And the level of freedom that he would give to the opposition. And the munafiqun of that time, they are the ones that we can call opposition now. They are the opposition. And Abdullah bin Ubay and these people, according to historical accounts, they had the freedom to make fun of the Prophet, to make fun of Muslims, and no one would do any harm to them. Not only that, the Prophet would still give them their share from Baytul Mal, from the money, the financial aid that was distributed among the members of the committee. They received that, and at the same time, they made fun of the Prophet and other Muslims. So, you see, this is the level of the freedom of opposition, and even the plots against the life of the Prophet, he forgave them. So that picture that he got aggressive and oppressive is all but a biased perspective with other goals, with other motives that some people, unfortunately, throughout history tried to depict from the Prophet. Okay, inshallah, we continue the discussion about other elements in the leadership of the Prophet in the next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Jannah, Jannah.
that's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever. It's all I ever wish for. Oh God, please don't deprive me of bliss for life eternally.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Across the crowded western areas of Khan Yunis, tents stretch as fragile shelters held up by one essential material, wood. Yet even the simplest material is denied to Gaza's displaced families. Wooden pallets once lying discarded on the roadside have become a treasure for anyone desperate to keep a tent standing against wind and rain. That's what Rami Ibrahim understood. With his worn-out saw and a rusty hammer, he set up a small makeshift workshop, salvaging every splinter he could collect. From sunrise to sunset, Rami and his children worked together, cracking boards apart, pounding nails, and joining short pieces into long, sturdy supports, repurposing scraps into the pillars that can hold fragile shelters standing.
Most of us now live in tents, as no caravans or suitable housing units have arrived. While many people break down these pallets for firewood, I try to collect them from those who fetch them after aid or commercial deliveries. My children and I carefully transform these scraps into something usable. I even built my own workshop structure from this wood. As the weather grows harsher, at least when people lose their tents, they can find an affordable alternative.
Here in Gaza, wood has become a rare commodity, not for furniture, but for survival. With materials blocked by Israel, the scraps of wood recycled here are the only option for many displaced families to hold their tents from collapsing.
For the displaced families, the fear is no longer limited to Israel's bombs. Even the weather can tear their tents down. On a nearby road, Abu Ihab has just got a few wooden boards from the workshop. He lays them to rebuild a new tent after his previous shelter collapsed under the brutal conditions. With only a handful of boards, he hopes this rebuilt structure will withstand the winds this time, offering his family even a fragile sense of stability.
This isn't the first time I've used these wooden boards. They cracked during the last storm and caused my tent to collapse. Now, I got them again from a nearby workshop. But we really need stronger wood and tarps. What would truly help are proper housing units. Yet, they still haven't arrived, leaving us trapped in this endless cycle.
For Abu Ihab and countless others, the meaning of refuge has long been lost in the ruins of the homes Israel destroyed. No matter how many times they rebuild or reinforce their tents, the struggle remains the same. Families continue searching for materials or any form of proper shelter, but what they truly need remains out of reach as long as Israel blocks the entry of essential construction supplies. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis, Palestine.
Pakistan's capital Islamabad marked the International Day of Commemoration and Dignity of the Victims of the Crime of Genocide and of the Prevention of this Crime. A seminar was held bringing together former diplomats, members of parliament, think tank researchers, university faculty members, and students. Speakers reflected on historic and ongoing genocides targeting Muslim communities, saying Gaza today represents the world's gravest moral failure.
9th December, and by the United Nations, it's declared as the Genocide Prevention Day, and especially to pay respect to the victims of different genocides. I must appreciate all the people in South Africa and all the other different countries, those have showed their courage to support this issue and to support the people of Palestine, and especially the students of different Western universities. They supported this issue more.
Participants described the situation in Gaza as catastrophic, urging Muslim countries to stand united to defend the rights of the Palestinian people. They said nations like Iran, which have shown firm diplomatic resolve and a strong stance against Israeli oppression, can send a powerful message to the world.
I think it requires the realization and united action by the entire Muslim community around the world. It is not only some people who raise their voices and it is then forgotten. Well, Iran has taken a stand which is a beacon of light for all of us.
Meanwhile, a Muslim unity conference was also held on the outskirts of Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Participants from diverse backgrounds rejected U.S. President Donald Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza, calling it a complete fraud.
The so-called peace promise made under Trump's leadership is nothing but a fraud. There is no ceasefire, the massacres continue, the genocide continues. Even the areas Israel was supposed to withdraw from remain under siege, and aid is still not reaching the people.
The participants emphasized that Gaza has become a defining test for the Islamic world, urging Muslim nations to take a united stand against occupation, injustice, and genocide of Israel.
Public anger keeps growing across Pakistan as the Israeli genocide in Gaza continues unabated amid international silence. Many fear that without global action, the catastrophic humanitarian crisis will intensify. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
The annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was observed at the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa compound in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa. A ceremony was held on Tuesday, bringing together representatives from the UN, the African Union, and ambassadors from various countries. The event highlighted decades of suffering faced by the Palestinian people, both in Gaza and the West Bank.
The Palestinian people's suffering has intensified under decades of a belligerent Israeli occupation, which has relentlessly targeted our land, the people, and every aspect of life in Palestine, culminating in an atrocious genocide in the Gaza Strip, confirmed by numerous UN and international human rights reports.
Injustice also continues in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, with Israel military operations, settlers, violence, settlement expansions, evictions, demolitions, and threats of annexations. At the same time, hundreds of humanitarian workers have been killed. The majority were Palestinians, UN staff, marking the largest loss of personnel in the organization's history. More journalists have perished than in any other conflict since the Second World War.
Participants expressed support for the Palestinians' legitimate rights, including the right to have independent states.
The Middle East region will not be able to emerge from the successive crises unless the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people to establish his own independent state are recognized.
Despite the UN's annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people and global calls to address the ongoing crisis, Palestinians continue to face a grave ordeal in the history of humanity. And this event in Addis Ababa urges the international community to move beyond rhetoric and support the legitimate resistance of the Palestinian people in their quest for self-determination.
As we reflect on the hardship endured by millions of Palestinians, we are reminded that solidarity is not merely symbolic. It is a moral imperative. It is a wake-up call to the international community to redouble its commitment.
The event concluded with the 40 exhibition featuring the tragedies occurring in Gaza, honoring ambassadors whose countries have recognized the state of Palestine, and the flag-raising ceremony. Amanil Gabramatin, Addis Ababa.
Officials from the three branches of government, along with leading experts, came together for the National Summit on Enhancing Transparency in Tehran. The event also marked International Anti-Corruption Day.
Transparency and administrative integrity lie at the heart of Islamic governance, which brings the officials of the Islamic Republic together.
Good governance depends on greater transparency and the elimination of conflict of interest situations. This gathering aimed to promote these principles and increase public understanding of the country's governing bodies and their performance.
The outcome of the scientific and expert discussions in this program must indeed be actionable recommendations that contribute to a culture of transparency, which is rooted in our Islamic Iranian heritage.
There is a direct correlation between transparency and conflict of interest, such that greater transparency will allow for easier identification of potential conflict of interest situations. The decisions made by officials across all sectors of governance must be made accessible to the public.
The meeting also focused on discussing policymaking, inspection, technical analysis, and the evaluation of anti-corruption measures, as well as mechanisms to oversee the implementation of the law.
Our country's judicial system, in its capacity as supervisor, will monitor the implementation of transparency initiatives. And at the Ministry of Agriculture, we have taken the lead on this issue by signing the relevant agreement.
Our primary objective is to ensure the seamless delivery of services, supported by administrative integrity and reduced operational costs, while maximizing transparency through the simplification of bureaucratic procedures.
According to Iran's General Inspection Office, the ultimate goal of this meeting is to establish a sustainable system for assessing administrative integrity and issuing administrative integrity report cards so that transparency and accountability become an integral part of the country's managerial culture. Mohin Amini, Tehran.
South Korea will increase its military spending by 7.5%, the most in 7 years. Although a culture of militarism pervades South Korea's society, many believe that money could be better spent.
I think 7.5% is a huge amount. I think it could be used for foreign aid for developing countries or other causes more beneficial than our military or the U.S. military.
Seoul's jump in defense spending comes at the insistence of U.S. President Donald Trump, who's alternated between threatening to withdraw U.S. forces and demanding ever larger sums for their deployment here.
South Koreans' confidence in the U.S. as an economic partner suffered with the expulsion of the country's high-tech workers from factory construction in the U.S. state of Georgia earlier this year. Trump's shift in the U.S. alliance commitment is compounding that unease.
In its national security strategy released this week, Washington neglected to even mention North Korea, South Korea's primary concern, instead highlighting the threat it sees from China. And the U.S. has also been pressuring South Korea to join its Beijing containment strategy, an unpopular policy in Seoul.
The U.S. might try to use South Korea to defend against China, but I think that's a dangerous idea, and I hope we don't get involved.
South Korean civic leader Lee Hong-jong warns of the dangers of getting involved in U.S. conflicts and contributing to the regional arms race.
If we continue to purchase U.S. strategic weapons, often in the name of national defense, and align ourselves with U.S. deterrence against China, it'll be extremely difficult to break free from this dependent defense system. Ultimately, boosting military spending will only exacerbate the threat of war and push the security crisis on the Korean Peninsula to the brink once again.
Instead, many activists here want South Korea to exercise greater independence, reduce military spending, and rekindle genuine dialogue with North Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The human cost of the war in Gaza is etched not only in the lives lost, but in thousands living with irreversible physical trauma. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, 6,000 people have undergone amputation since the start of Israel's genocidal war, an explosion of suffering that has reshaped entire families and communities.
Before the war, there were around 1,500 cases, resulting also from Israeli attacks. Now, after the war, the number increased to be over 7,500. This is an indication of their continuous suffering. The prosthetics are not available, and the lack of rehabilitation make the task of this center more challenging.
The ministry reports that children make up one in every four amputees. Their lives are abruptly transformed before they even learn to dream freely. Women account for 12.5%. Many having lost limbs while trying to protect their families or flee bombardments.
Every day, we suffer much because we don't have sufficient supportive equipment or prosthetics. Moving from one place to another is a struggle because roads are battered and damaged in the war, and the transportations are difficult.
I used to borrow the walking stick from my neighbor. At first, I got shrapnel from an Israeli attack that caused my amputation. And 1 year after the amputation, I am still getting rehabilitation with difficulty, as the cases are a lot and the center is overwhelmed.
Behind each number is a story of terror survived. Yet survival, doctors warn, is only the beginning. Gaza's shattered health system offers little for those who must now learn to live differently. Rehabilitation centers lie in ruins, prosthetics labs lack the most basic materials, and patients often leave operating rooms to a reality without therapy, mobility aids, or even adequate pain relief.
For Gaza's amputees, the struggle now is not only for survival, but for dignity, mobility, and the ability of rebuilding hope in a place where so much has been reduced to rubble. At Ibrahim for Deir al-Balah City, Palestine.
This life as you know, you reap what you sow. And when you do good, Allah will protect you and stop you falling down. Allah, we surrender, 'cause he knows all. Compromise, here's your life.
ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a very important topic, and that topic is related to a subject which is very important in Islam. I'm speaking about judgment or qadawat or qada. Of course, it's necessary to remind our readers here that we're talking here about the judgment that a judge, a qazi, passes in court. We're not talking about, like, you know, an assessment that, you know, any and every person can and do, right? So obviously Islam has said certain things about this very important topic. Islam has been, is, you know, there are certain conditions. Not every person can become a judge in Islam, and obviously there are certain etiquettes for this. Today in The Key, we want to ask, what are these etiquettes? And we're going to look at some of the hadiths which have been passed down to us from the infallibles regarding this topic. In one beautiful hadith, the Prophet said, whoever is stricken with having to judge between Muslims must do so with fairness in his glance, his indications, his sittings, and his gatherings. So one of the the etiquettes is that a person should act with equity between opposing plaintiffs. Imam Ali alayhi salam, while addressing a person called Shuraih, said this, and act with equity between the Muslims, with your face, speech, and sitting, in order that those who are close to you will not hope for bias from you, nor will your enemies despair of your justice. This kind of reinforces what the previous hadith said. In another beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that Imam Ali alayhi salam said this. He said this to Abu al-Aswad ad-Duali. When he asked the Imam about the reason why he was discharged from being a judge, when he had neither been treacherous nor committed a crime, right? Imam said, I saw that your voice was raised above the voice of your plaintiffs. Right, so this is another one of the etiquettes of the judge. The judge shouldn't raise his voice above that of the plaintiff. In another beautiful hadith, the Imam said, again, Imam Ali said, he said this to Shuraih, beware of becoming bored and irritated in the court of justice, wherein God has prescribed a reward, and for which there will be good provision for he who judges honestly. Right, so not becoming irritated and bored, this is one of the etiquettes of the judge. Another etiquette is to not pass judgment before listening to both sides. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said this to Imam Ali, when two people bring a case against each other before you to be judged, do not judge the first before you hear out the second. If you adhere to this, judging will become clear for you. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, and after that I continued to be a judge. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said this, supplicating to him, O Allah, make him understand judgment. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the etiquettes of judgment in the light of the hadith of the infallibles alayhim salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
from east to west. Throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
The ceasefire between Israel and Gaza faces a critical test. Hamas has rejected any discussion of phase two negotiations as illegitimate, while accusing Israel of breaching the agreement and disregarding its obligations. The controversial Yellow Line declaration is cited as evidence that Israel is not honoring the deal. Hamas insists that before any further talks can proceed, phase one must be fully implemented, a complete cessation of Israeli killings, the opening of humanitarian aid corridors, and the full withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. The fate of the ceasefire now hinges on whether these demands are met or whether mistrust and violations will push both sides back into open conflict. Welcome to Spotlight. I am Bahman Roy. Let us begin with a report.
The US-led peace process for Gaza faces a crisis of credibility. President Trump insists on launching phase two of his plan soon, involving international forces and a new governance council. For him, the phase is already underway, but on the ground, the core commitments of phase one are shattered.
President Trump, can you tell us when phase two of the negotiations will begin?
Well, it started. I mean, it started as far as we're concerned. Phase two has started. And, you know, the phases are all a little bit mixed in with each other. You're going to start cleaning up. You look at Gaza, and it's a lot of cleanup.
Israeli occupation forces have declared they are not going to withdraw. They have solidified control over a massive Yellow Line interior zone, annexing over 55% of Gaza's territory for what Israeli Army Chief of Staff, Erel Zami, calls a new border. Inside this occupied area, home demolitions continue. Outside it, Palestinians are shot. Almost 740 Israeli violations have resulted in the death of nearly 390 Palestinians since the ceasefire began. Hamas has strongly rejected the launching of phase two. Senior official Hussam Badran says any talk of phase two is illegitimate while Israel continues to breach the agreement and disregards its obligations. Hamas condemned the Yellow Line declaration as proof that the regime does not honor the deal. The resistance movement demands full implementation of phase one, including a complete stop to killings, open aid corridors, and Israeli occupation forces withdrawal before any new discussions. For Palestinians, phase one's humanitarian, political, and military promises remain unfulfilled. Would Israeli forces pull out of Gaza as required by phase one, or would they continue to violate the truce by killing more Palestinians in Gaza and keeping their land under occupation?
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Reza Vedadi, academic researcher and author, joining us from London. And Mick Napier, co-founder of a Scottish-Palestine solidarity campaign, joining us from Glasgow. Gentlemen, very good to have you on the programme. I'm going to start with Mick right now. Well, why does Hamas consider phase two negotiations illegitimate at this stage?
Because everything that Israel committed to do on paper under pressure from Mr. Trump, they violated. And you can see that in the detail today and over the last couple of weeks. But more importantly, you can see it in the entire history of the Zionist project. And if you think about it, if there's a conflict between two sides, Cambodia and Thailand, or other, you know, Ukraine, Russia, and so on, a negotiated settlement is possible. In fact, it usually happens after a war. But that's not the situation for the Palestinians. the Zionist project doesn't involve the idea of negotiating with Palestinians because they are slated for disappearance. You don't negotiate with people whom, at the end of the day, you will simply expel. And so anything that Israel commits to paper is only a holding operation until the next offensive. And that's what we've seen in Gaza. It's no surprise to anyone who looks at the entire history. If you look at the Oslo Agreement, Israel violated the terms of the Oslo Agreement from the very start. So that's what we're looking at. It's shocking, but not remotely surprising to anyone who's looked at Israeli history. And in a sense, the Israelis can't possibly treat the Palestinians as equals. If even Netanyahu, in a parallel universe, decided to do that, behind him, the Zionist project, the genocidal state over 70 years, has created Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and so on, and they would simply bring the government down. So the commitment to ongoing ethnic cleansing up till the present day, the yellow line, Israel decides to hold on to it rather than vacate, this doesn't come as a surprise to anyone.
Right, Reza, I want to talk to you about the other side of this deal. The Israelis are pressuring and insisting on moving forward despite not fulfilling any part of the phase one completely. How can that be justified, this demand?
It can't be justified. The whole operation of this peace or ceasefire that is not really a ceasefire. I mean, look, Israel has a habit of going around in the region signing up to ceasefires, but not then agreeing to it and breaking them. We know that in south of Lebanon, since they apparently came to ceasefire with Hezbollah, they've broken it 1,000 times, either through military incursions by air or by land. And since the ceasefire in Palestine, in Gaza, they've broken it nearly 1,000 times. They've bombed women, men, children, tents. They haven't allowed tents to come in. So their plan is to starve and kill the Palestinians. They show the facade, and that whole Donald Trump peace summit that invited Indonesian Prime Minister, President, and heads of other states was just for show. It was just an illusion, a control of the narrative to make the people around the world think there is some kind of a peace. But in reality, it was the slow genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza.
Right. I want to focus on the accusations of breach by the Israeli forces now, Mick. What specific obligations does Hamas claim Israel has disregarded?
I'm not sure of the detail of this, but one of them was to withdraw. And now we hear the head of the military saying that they will entrench themselves behind on the yellow line and not give up an inch of it. As your other guest says, there's a long history of Israel showing that for them to sign a deal means absolutely nothing when the balance of power shifts in their direction. So there are other commitments as well to release Palestinian prisoners and so on. But Israel can never be trusted to follow any of those. And the statement from the head of the military that they're going to see the yellow line as a new border, it's not just a violation of what was signed. It's so obvious, it's undeniable. It cannot be seen as anything else by any sensible person. But that's what Israel is doing. For them, it's always been that might equals right. That if they have the power to do something, to violate, to assault, to attack, to dispossess, they will do so in their own, in their own time. They're very alert to international pressure, real pressure. And if that were to come from America, then they would desist. But they think they've got a green light from Trump at the moment, and they think that they can do this, and that's why they've done it. So the Hamas complaint is absolutely valid. It's valid 100 times over. But language is the language that we use in this program. Words mean what they mean. Ceasefire means ceasefire. You stop killing. But in the Israeli parlance, ceasefire means continue the killing in a particular way, and you'll get away with it. And violation of the agreement, they will never accept that they've violated the agreement. But for them, Golda Meir and Ben-Gurion from the very beginning said that, you know, the only constraint on the expansion of Israel was the balance of power at a particular moment. And that what they said, Jews, right. i.e. Zionist Jews, will occupy whatever they want, when they want. That's what we are seeing now in real time.
Indeed. Well, Reza, Mick just pointed out the fact that the Yellow Line Declaration was a huge bridge. How significant do you believe this declaration is as a proof of Israel's non-compliance with the ceasefire?
I mean, Israel doesn't need evidence to prove that it's non-compliance with any ceasefire. But in this case, the fact that they are occupying an occupied land, so in the sense that Gaza itself was previously occupied, they withdrew from it, and now they're occupying it again, and they're using this occupation as a method to cleanse the area that they've occupied, which is called the Yellow Area, and push the remaining Palestinians into the area which is not fertile. The land, the Yellow Area that they are occupying, is the most fertile part of Gaza, and they're trying to starve the Palestinians slowly, or kill them, or shoot them, or have them put onto flights, taken away to different parts of the world, or pushed into Egypt, or whatever they can. So for them, the process, the aim is to cleanse that area of Palestinians. The process has changed. Before, it was a year or two of complete bombing and snipering and killing and burying alive people, Palestinians. Now it's on a slower pace. It's like as if someone's cooking something. Instead of trying to get it done quickly in the microwave, they put it on a slow cook. So the Israelis have, and the only pressure that they understand is the pressure of force. And without America, with America's support and European support, it's very difficult for them to realize, for any country to put pressure on them to abide by any ceasefire.
Right, Mick, the most obvious result of any ceasefire must be, of course, a cease of fire. And a cessation of killings is something the least that any party needs to be able to count on. But what should Hamas do right now? Should Hamas be looking for a ceasefire within a ceasefire? You know, doesn't this make the entire deal so ridiculous?
Hamas are in a very difficult situation. The Israelis certainly started the spike in genocide 2 years ago by saying that they would drive Hamas out of the whole of Gaza. Hamas would be obliterated and destroyed. That hasn't happened. But the overwhelming power, the 2,000-pound bombs that Israel can drop on Gaza, the equivalent of all the atom bombs of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and more, means that Hamas has suffered terribly. Now, every colonial struggle, anti-colonial struggle, the people fighting suffer terribly. But in this occasion, it's really almost without precedent in the history of the human race. So Hamas is in a very, very difficult situation. They don't have allies in many of the Arab countries across the region. They're in Trump's pocket, and some of them are working with Israel under the table. So they're very vulnerable. The only hope that Hamas have, I mean, their courage, their determination. I'm saying things which in Britain will get me arrested, but who cares? The courage and heroism of the Palestinian resistance, specifically of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, is almost without equal in human history as well. But they are now alone. The Hezbollah has been weakened in Lebanon. They're still fighting. Israel hasn't won the fight, but they have weakened the opposition. So they don't have a lot of choices. I think they have to accept some kind of ceasefire. But really, they have to hold on until a wave of resistance comes to their support. And that means across the region and across the whole world, including America, Britain, Europe, and so on. Our own government is jailing thousands of people, or charging thousands of people with terrorism for trying to support the Palestinians. It's a fight now between worldwide public opinion, which can it be channeled in time, and the disappearance of the Palestinians, abandoned by the collective West and by many of these Arab regimes. They don't have a lot of options.
Right, Reza. The other demand from phase one was, of course, the opening of the crossings. Even yet, I think it was yesterday or the day before, that the Israelis said, we are willing to open the Rafah crossing only for the Palestinians to exit the territory with no return. So, you know, how could this happen under a ceasefire? What are the mediators doing right now?
Well, this just supports my argument that this is a slow ethnic cleansing compared to the faster ethnic cleansing before the ceasefire. And my colleague in Scotland, he just demonstrated that the fact that you are not able to condemn the genociders and praise or support those resisting genocide in a free democratic country explains why they're able to close the Rafah border, why they're able to kill people, innocent people, without any fear of justice. You have a prime minister, for goodness sake, who has a court order against him that needs to be brought to the International Court of Justice, and he's going around the world and doing what he wants. I mean, when you have some that situation like that, they can do whatever they're literally doing whatever they want. They close Rafah border, they'll kill anyone that goes into the sea, into the Mediterranean from the Gaza, bury people alive. They don't allow journalists in. They're the third, three years in a row now, the most killers of journalists is Israel. But no one's talking about this in Western media. The narrative doesn't come out. No one in Western legacy media discusses it. We have to discuss it on Press TV. We have to discuss it maybe on RT or the podcasts, which are resisting the legacy media. So the fact that the politics and the media support the ethnic cleansing, they're able to get away with closing the Rafah border and other crimes, war crimes.
Well, of course, make the human situation is indeed grave in Gaza right now, all over Palestine. Do you believe that now humanitarian guarantees should be prioritized over political negotiations in any future negotiation?
I think in Gaza and Palestine, and really in any consideration, humanitarian and political considerations are inseparable, because the only way that humanitarian aid will reach the violated people of Gaza is by a political pressure coming through Western governments, from public opinion, and also Arab populations as well, to make their feelings known, to demand that humanitarian aid be allowed through. There's no doubt at all that if the pressure is great enough, the aid will go through. But it's a political issue, and it can only be resolved in the short term politically and in the long term politically as well. Look, Gaza, I read a few months ago, Gaza has the highest rate of child amputees, not just in war, but in human history. The gravity of the situation defies our ability to find the language to describe it, but facts like that help. The merciless barbarism of the Israelis filming their own crimes is a level of impunity that we didn't even see in Vietnam or Algeria or anywhere else. So the impunity stems from the fact that Western governments ally actively with Israel and against any notion of Palestinian freedom and justice and human rights. I mean, we've never seen an example. We've seen terrible crimes committed by the collective West for the last 500 years, genocide after genocide, huge genocides, bigger than the current one. What we haven't seen is this happening in the public view, and Western governments, knowing that public opinion is opposed to this, nonetheless pushing the sale of arms and diplomatic protection to Netanyahu and the genocidal state. That impunity comes down to grassroots level in the Israeli army, and that's why they feel able to film themselves committing these terrible crimes. So if you think about it, one other thing, the late unlamented Humanitarian Foundation, which the Americans and the Israelis forced, that was run by a substantial part by a motorcycle gang. Really, motorcycle gang members were recruited in America at a very high daily rate and sent to snipe Palestinians queuing up for food and bread. That level of impunity is what needs to be tackled. And it's a fight between not just the heroic resistance of Palestine against the Zionist project, but all around the world it's a fight between public opinion and pro-Israeli governments.
Right, Reza, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the role of the U.S. here. The U.S., of course, played a lot of publicity and propaganda over the peace deal with the Cairo summit and everything. And at the same time, now President Trump seems to be a little detached from reality when commenting on the situation here, always talking of a wonderful peace that is holding in Gaza. And what is the responsibility of the U.S. right now in all of this?
Well, the United States is led by a president who has the attention of a five-year-old. It was at that time it suited him to show that he's brought this peace for the Palestinians. And then once he got what he wanted, the media narrative spin on it, he's moved on to something else. He's focused on Venezuela. Now he's trying to bring some kind of a peace in between Ukraine and Russia. And he jumps to different things. There's no doubt that this President Trump has been the most supportive of the genocidal attempts by Israel. And there's no doubt that, as Ayatollah Khamenei has said many times, that Israel is not a state like normal other states. It's a colonial outpost for the United States and the European. When you look at the ethnic makeup of these Israelis that live there, majority of them come from Europe, Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and the United States, and countries like this. So America, it's part of the American policy to support Israel as much as possible. And that's why it's going to be very difficult to get peace. However, I do want to make a point that my colleague Mick raised in Scotland. If the Arabs and the countries around Israel, Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and these other countries, stop supporting directly and indirectly Israel, it would make the task of the resistance much easier to defend themselves.
Right, and one final question, Mick. Of course, as you said, the situation is very precarious right now. Do you believe external mediators can now bridge the gap between Hamas's demands and the Israeli stance?
That doesn't depend on what's written on paper, because if that were to be enforced, then the Hamas minimal positions would be met, and they would have the possibility of a stable ceasefire. What needs to be done in order to bridge the gap is pressure needs to be put on Israel. If Trump picked up the phone and said, I want my Nobel Peace Prize, I demand that you commit to X, Y, and Z, it would happen. Netanyahu could not possibly stand against Trump. We saw that a few months ago when he did want his Nobel Peace Prize. And when Netanyahu went to Washington and sat beside Donald Trump, I watched that scene and I thought, really, he should have been sitting on Donald Trump's knee, because it was quite clear what the power relationship was between the two. And that's still the case. If America or even Europe decided to vigorously challenge Israel, then a real ceasefire could be achieved. But at the moment, all that Netanyahu sees is a bright green light to carry on with everything that he's been doing for 2 years. I mean, we have to remind ourselves what he's been doing for 2 years. It's unspeakable, and that tells us all we need to know about the current situation. Pressure needs to be, the threat of sanctions from the governments need to be raised against Israel in order for them to be brought to heel. They're an attack dog for the West, and an attack dog sometimes bites its master, but ultimately the master has the power if they choose to use it.
It was indeed a pleasure to talk to you, gentlemen, and I wish I could continue the conversation with you for longer, but for the timing purposes, we have to end this right now. Reza Vedari, academic researcher and author, joining us from London, and Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, joining us from Glasgow. And one final comment, the truth will always come out. Whether you stand with it or not is what really matters. I am Bahman Rai.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
the UN and Gaza officials warned that Israel's restrictions on aid entry have left thousands of people without shelter amid torrential rains and severe flooding. Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro sharply condemns the US seizure of an oil tanker in the Caribbean, calling it an act of criminal naval piracy. And the U.S. Senator bitterly criticizes President Trump for deploying troops to American cities, calling it a staggering and unlawful waste of taxpayers' money. A very good morning to you from Tehran, Iran. I'm Bahman Urayyan. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has raised a serious alarm about the worsening humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza amid torrential rains and severe flooding. Philippe Lazzarini warned that the ongoing storm Byron is sharply aggravating the already dire humanitarian crisis in Gaza. He added that the storm has Gaza in its grip. Lazzarini said Palestinians who have lost everything due to war are now facing a new wave of suffering. According to the UNRWA chief, heavy rains and strong winds pose severe challenges to thousands of displaced families living in makeshift shelters made of plastic sheets and fragile material. Gaza's government media office also warned that thousands of displaced people are facing extremely harsh conditions due to lack of proper shelter and basic necessities. It said Israel continues to obstruct reconstruction efforts by restricting aid entry, exacerbating the suffering of over 1.5 million displaced